Title is The Devil's in the Detail, and that's absolutely true from having read through this stuff. I can tell you that it is. Quite apart from the big ticket items that have been trailed in advance in many of the press releases so far, there are also some relatively small changes that will nevertheless have an effect on some of the things that you do in your daily practice. Just a little bit of background for any of you in the audience who aren't totally familiar with how we got to where we are today. This won't take too long. The review process for the Community Trademark Regulation and the Directive started back in 2007. So it's been quite a long time coming. The Max Planck Institute published its review in 2011. It was then 2 years of sitting around with people cogitating on what it all meant, and then the Commission came up with some proposals in 2013. That, of course, went off to the Council and the European Parliament, and they had some more to-ing and fro-ing, and European politics being what it is, there were various interests and so on being pushed backwards and forwards about some of the proposals that were put forward. And it all went a bit quiet, and everyone started thinking, when's it going to get taken forward? And then in early this year, I think it was around about April, there was a sudden announcement from the Commission that the so-called trilogue, which is the Commission, the Council and the Parliament, had done a deal. And then in June of this year, a compromise proposal suddenly emerged. And it's that compromise proposal that I've looked at for the purpose of giving this talk today. Now, my personal view on it is that compared to where Max Planck was taking it in some areas, it's actually a pretty conservative document. There isn't really a great deal in there that's going to set the world on fire, unfortunately. And some of Max Planck's more radical suggestions, particularly relating to confining double identity situations to the origin indication function of the mark, issues around genuine use, and in particular where marks are remote from each other within the European Union, and even something as straightforward, you think, as bringing bad faith into the opposition phase, those don't seem to have been taken through. On the other hand, some of the more recent case developments, for example, IP Translator, Nokia, and even going back as far as Davidoff, have found their way into the legislation. So there's been some updating. Anyway, what I'm going to be looking at is the 8th of June proposal as it currently stands. I'm going to be looking mostly at the law side of that. I should point out, for anyone who's daft enough to want to read the thing, a large chunk of this inch and a half of document is actually procedure that's been imported in from the implementing regulation. They've put a lot of that in and given the Commission, at least, delegated powers to issue further implementing regulations as we go along, rather than have to have this static implementing reg that would require a great deal of work to be changed. I'm not going to be looking at the Trademarks Directive. There simply isn't time this afternoon. What I'm really proposing to do is I'll talk for as long as it takes. I'm going to try and keep it as brief as possible because I know it's that time of day where you can all see another glass of wine beckoning. And this stuff is not exactly going to keep you awake. If I get to 15 minutes and the man over there waves a hand at me, I'm just going to stop wherever I am, okay? So I'm going to try not to run over. Chris, throw something at me if I don't see your signal. Anyway, not right now, you don't have to have a practice run, but later on, just lob something soft, preferably. Right, so, here we go. Article 2 of the Community Trademark Regulation and some recitals are going to be changed. Community trademark is going to become European Union trademark. Believe it or not, there was apparently quite a bit of debate about this. The original proposal in the 2013 draft was they were going to call it the European trademark. Trouble is, as somebody pointed out, Europe isn't quite the same as European Union. European Union's a little bit smaller than Europe at the current time, although they clearly have ambitions to get a bit bigger. So they've called it the European Union trademark. As a result of that, the community trademark courts become the European Union Trademark Courts. Throughout the document, a reference to community is going to become union. Doesn't it seem a long time ago that we had a European community? It must be 20, 30 years now, isn't it? Oh, I miss it. President of the office becomes executive director. Now, one can only guess at the political issues that were going on around that title, but I guess some people thought the presidential was just that, too presidential. Executive director is more in keeping with the leader of an organisation that's effectively performing a sort of management function. And naturally enough, OHIM becomes the European Union Intellectual Property Office. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm going to miss OHIM. I thought Office for Harmonisation in the Internal Market, whilst it wasn't necessarily particularly pithy, had acquired a certain piquance. I certainly liked it. It's what you get used to, isn't it? That and the fact that it seemed to be totally different in terms of the initials in every single language in the European Union. So I would like to bid a fond farewell to O him. I shall miss it desperately. It's also arguable that European Union Intellectual Property Office is itself not entirely accurate. Because after all, they're not covering all intellectual property of the registered kind, are they? They're not covering copyright, of course, unregistered, but the UK IPO does do so. And they certainly won't have any handle on patents. So maybe they're, again, maybe they have ambitions for the future. Who knows? Stranger things have happened. They take a long view. Now, Mary Bagnall, are you still here? Where have you gone? Thank you very much for covering off this slide earlier on today. Basically, I understand you've already been taken through the changes to Article 4 and the definition of signs, particularly around the requirement of graphic representation. So I'm not going to talk any more about that. What I would say, though, is that I'm not entirely certain that the requirement that the sign be rendered in a manner which enables the competent authorities and the public to determine the clear and precise subject matter is itself going to be clear and precise. What does clear and precise actually mean? It's unclear and imprecise. However, that is language that was taken from the Seekman case. And it's good enough for the CJEU, it's good enough for us for the time being. It's difficult to find a form of words that would really do the job, but I guess it will have to do. As you know, it's going to include, they've included sounds in the new definition. Mary, are you still here? I gather you've done 7-1-E as well. This is great because it means we might get out a little bit earlier. Am I right that Mary has covered off 7-1-A pretty much? Okay. Well, I won't talk a great deal about it other than to say, as you can see from the definition of the items which can be refused registration, it's no longer just a shape which result from the nature of the goods or the technical result or that which gives substantial value. It's a shape or another characteristic. Now, that clearly envisages the possibility that there are other technical issues which people might seek to register and which should be excluded. And remember that there is a permanent exclusion on all of these items. What could be another characteristic? Well, it's all very well introducing sounds, for example, into the definition of a sign, but one example of another characteristic that might be excluded under, for example, 7-1-E-1, another characteristic resulting from the nature of the goods, would be, as particularly of interest to me as a motorcyclist, some of you who are a bit longer in the tooth might remember that Harley-Davidson applied to register the sound of a Harley-Davidson motorcycle in the USA. It's going back a good few years. Apparently, I've never ridden one, so I don't know, apparently a Harley-Davidson makes a sound potato, potato. Something like that. It's got a very distinctive sound arising from the configuration of the engine. Now, I don't know if that particular sound mark was registered. I can't recall. But it seems to me that if you were to try that here, under this regulation, it would fail. Simply because that sound is created, no matter how you do it, as a result of the goods themselves. Either the arrangement of the exhaust pipes, or the arrangement of the valves, the camshafts, whatever it is. It's something to do with how the product actually works. It arises from the function. So that's the sort of thing I think that is a good example of what would be excluded under the other characteristic. Now, interestingly enough, looking for example at substantial value, the Max Planck review didn't like that exclusion at all. In fact, they wanted to get rid of it. Or alternatively, they suggested, saying that 7-1-E-3, shape of goods which gives substantial value to the goods, that marks having those characteristics should be registrable on evidence of acquired distinctive character. Needless to say, that hasn't found any favour. I said this was a conservative approach to reform, and that didn't get through. Let's see what else we've got here. There are a couple of relatively minor changes. So there's going to be a new subsection J which will exclude geographical indications and protected designations of origin. In fact, that's already in there. It's really just rearranging things a little bit. And also sub K and KA will exclude traditional terms for wine, again already covered, but a new one, the exclusion of traditional specialities guaranteed. Do you all know what traditional specialities guaranteed are? I'm not hearing a lot of people saying yes. I didn't know until... Ah, gentleman at the back there seems to be there. Would you like to tell us, sir? Yes, that's the sort of thing. Agricultural products produced... That's right, agricultural products produced by traditional means in a traditional way. So, nice to know they managed to get that one in. And also, plant variety names are going to be brought into the excluded items as well. Relative grounds for refusal, not much to change there. There is going to be a new Article 8.4a, so it's an additional earlier right, just bringing... geographical indications and protected designations of origin into the fold. If you are an appropriately authorised person under a GI or a PDO, you will be able to bring an opposition under 8.4a. 8.5, unfair advantage, unfair detriment, that has been tweaked to bring it up to date with the Davidoff case. Davidoff seems an awfully long time ago. They've now changed the wording so that it will cover not just dissimilar goods or services, but also similar goods or services, and also identical goods and services. Now, there was a suggestion by Max Planck that they would also introduce a requirement for use in accordance with honest practices in the trade. Needless to say, that didn't survive into either draft. But there was also a suggestion, let's go back one, there was also a suggestion that bad faith as a ground of opposition should be brought into Article 8. That didn't get through, didn't survive. And there was also a proposal to import wording that pretty much looked like Article 44G of the Trademark Directive. Okay, I can see people going, what on earth is 44G? And I could just assume that you all know because you all memorise this stuff off by heart. But just so it happens, I read a case on it the other week. The case was Unilever against Technopharma. 44G is another bad faith provision, and it relates specifically to a situation where somebody has use abroad, and it's alleged that, notwithstanding they have no use here, it would be bad faith to file that application here. There was a lot of talk in Unilever and Technopharma about whether or not that had effect here, but clearly it's not going to be brought into the Community Trademark Regulation. It's a specific ground of opposition. Right, Article 9. Starts to get a little bit, I say it starts to get exciting, but that would be misleading you. It doesn't really. Article 9 has been pretty much replaced with new text, although a lot of that text simply repeats what was there before. They obviously decided it was going to be much easier to just put in a brand new article rather than try and put in amendments and so on. Now, all the basic rights, the right to prevent identical mark on identical goods and so on, all those things go into Article 9.2. But the intro to Article 9.2 makes it clear that those exclusive rights are without prejudice to prior rights. That wasn't there before. And so, because of changes that are being made to Article 99, which if we have time we'll get onto later, that effectively means that if you are attacked for infringement and you can rely on an earlier right, you no longer have to defend that by effectively bringing an invalidity claim against the mark that's attacking it. That was the implication in Article 99. It specifically said that you more or less have to bring an invalidity allegation in order to defend the matter. That's gone. You will now be able to defend based on the fact you have a prior right. You won't have to go through this invalidity of the circuitous route. And that was a recommendation of the Max Planck Institute. There was quite a lot of debate over the years about double indemnity. Sorry, not double indemnity, double identity. So identical mark, identical goods or services. And which of the various trademark functions that should apply to. Max Planck wanted to limit it to the origin indicative function of trademark. So you could only claim infringement in that situation where it was an origin indicative usage of the mark you were attacking. That did appear in the 2013 draft of this proposal. It didn't survive. It's gone. Don't know why. Obviously, somebody didn't like that somewhere along the line. Maybe they just thought it would create too many difficulties in terms of getting agreement across the board from all 27 countries in the Parliament, but it has gone. Right, Article 9.3. That Article 9.3 covers the acts which amount to infringement, so affixing a mark, putting on the market, and so on. Been a couple of changes there, some additions. First of all, we've got use as part of a trade or company name will now infringe. So will use in comparative advertising, which is contrary to the comparative advertising directive. So that's bringing us up to date with L'Oreal and cases like that. There is a new provision, which is 9.5, which deals with the Nokia situation. Now, just refresh your memories, I'm sure you will know it anyway, but the Nokia situation was that there were some goods in transit through the European Union, didn't enter the customs territory as such, they weren't in free circulation, they were in a bonded warehouse, I think, or certainly on a dockside somewhere, and Nokia tried to assert their trademarks against these particular goods. And after some lengthy discussion at the CJEU, it was held, you can't do that, because they're not in circulation in the European Union. They were going to a country where they would have infringed. And obviously Nokia wanted to grab them here while they still had the chance. Article 9.5 puts that situation right. So it effectively says that you can prevent transit imports that aren't coming in for free circulation if they bear an identical mark or a mark which cannot be distinguished in its essential aspects. You just know there's going to be a lot of litigation around that phrase, don't you? I'm just so looking forward to that. However, the right to prevent the dealings in those goods will lapse if it emerges in the proceedings that the proprietor cannot prohibit marketing in the country of final destination. So if it turns out the proprietor doesn't have a right in that country of final destination, the goods will go free. And there's a suggestion in the recitals that the proprietor who sought to assert his right might be liable for damages as well. I can't actually find any reference to that in the proposal, but there's mention of it in the recital. There was an attempt to try to make an infringement for you, for someone as a private individual, to import goods which had the mark on, potentially genuine in the country of origin, into the European Union for private use. That got kicked out, didn't survive. Right to prohibit preparatory acts in relation to the use of packaging or other means. This is a new article, Article 9A. It says that where the risk exists, another piece of beautifully vague wording, I do love these, that the packaging or authentication marks, seals, labels, that sort of thing, to which the mark is affixed, will be used in relation to goods or services, and the use in relation to those goods or services would constitute infringement, then the proprietor gets to stop it if he wants to. So he can prevent them actually being stuck on goods or used in relation to services, and he can prevent those items, labels, whatever they are, being offered for sale, placed on the market, or being stocked. New Article 9b is just a reenactment of old 9.3 and just deals with the date from which the rights actually prevail, so I'm not going to spend any more time on that. Article 12. This is actually quite an interesting article when you drill down into it, because there's some quite subtle changes. Well, the first one isn't that subtle, I have to say. Basically, it takes away the own name defence for corporate entities. The own name, the use of the mark as part of your own name cannot be relied on unless you are a natural person. And that means that a case like Mayer and Assos, where Assos successfully relied on the own name defence, would be decided differently. They would infringe under this new article. The descriptive indication subsection, I think it was 12.1b, indications concerning time, nature, geographical, manufacture, and so on, that's been tweaked slightly, so it doesn't just include descriptive indications, it will now include non-distinctive signs. So if you're using a non-distinctive sign and someone is trying to assert that for whatever reason that sign is, for example, included in a registered trademark and therefore can be asserted against you, you'll be able to say, that's fine, I'm covered by Article 12.1b and I do not infringe. Article 12.1c has been brought up to date, or brought up to date, has been amended in quite an interesting way. It's no longer limited to goods which are intended to indicate the intended purpose of the goods. It now includes the use of a mark to identify or refer to goods as those of the proprietor, in particular to indicate the intended purpose of the goods. So we've still got the accessories or spares qualification there, but it's a general provision now saying that if all you're really doing is referring to these goods or services as being those of the proprietor, that will not infringe. Now, you may have thought that was there already, but it seems that there have been at least some discussions about the possibility that, for example, using a mark in relation to the resale of goods that have already been put on the market might in some circumstances infringe. This is designed to get around that. Now, the requirement that these uses should be used in accordance with honest practices in industrial and commercial matters, that's been moved into a separate article all of its own. It's now in 12.2. Back in 2013, it was suggested that there ought to be a list of examples indicating what was not honest use. Not surprisingly, because it'd be impossible to give an exhaustive list, I guess, that's been taken out. Now, the Max Planck Institute also suggested that there should be a limitation to allow for artistic expression, freedom of expression, parody rights, and so on. That didn't get into the 2013 proposal, but buried in the recitals to the current proposal is a reference to that. It's been added back in. Curiously enough, it doesn't appear in the amended article. So what I'm suspicious of here is that someone's just cut and pasted the original one, stuck it into the new one, forgotten all about it. It will be interesting to see if that parodic and artistic expression survives, gets actually put back in prior to this document being agreed. I rather hope that it does. It brings it into line with recent developments in copyright and so on. And let's face it, it's possible to waste an awful lot of time, effort and so on chasing down what are effectively harmless uses in ordinary media use. We've all done it. Article 13, exhaustion of rights. Currently, of course, that relates to first marketing in the community. Well, they're going to change that, not even just to refer to first marketing in the European Union. It's going to be first marketing in the European Economic Area, which is wider than the European Union. So include Norway, for example, and I think Switzerland's still in. Yes, include there as well. That lines up with the trademark directive. There's going to be a new Article 13A to deal with intervening rights, which basically says the use of a later European Union trademark or national registration can't be prevented if it can't be invalidated on certain grounds. So if the proprietor of the attacking CTM is seeking to attack it and he's done certain things, he won't be able to succeed. The things are, was the mark registered with his consent? If so, then can't oppose the use of the later CTM. Is he stopped because he's brought a previous invalidity claim by way of an application to the office, or indeed to by way of a counterclaim in court? Because if you do that, you only get one shot. You can't raise in a subsequent claim something you should have raised the first time around. If he's acquiesced, that'll close it out as well. And if he's unable to prove genuine use, that'll close it out too. The corollary of that, of course, is that the proprietor of the later mark cannot object to the use of the earlier European Union trademark. Now, before we go on, would anyone now like to watch the rugby instead of listening to more of this? And a forest of hands go up. What's the score, Richard?
It's full-time.
Full-time. And what was the score?
45-10
to Scotland.
Since when are you Scottish?
I play in a Scottish band, mate. Okay, well, we should be able to skim through a few of these slides now. How much time have I got left, Chris?
As long as you want.
Oh dear, you don't want that, surely.
You've got about 14 minutes.
Okay,
I throw something in.
Excellent, okay. I'm just trying to work out what you're going to throw. Right, Article 15, a minor tweak. This now specifically says that use of a mark, genuine use of a mark, can include use in a form which does not alter the distinctive character of the mark in the form in which it is registered, regardless of whether the form as used is also registered. And that's designed to reverse the effect of the Bainbridge decision, which said, basically, if you've got minor variants that aren't registered, and you've got different registrations for the minor variants, you can't rely on the use of one of those variants to support one of the other registrations. And that's been tweaked up to get rid of that problem. I included this one simply because, although it's not of any great importance, it struck me as quite an odd one. Article 17 deals with the transfer of community trademarks, European Union trademarks. And buried in the existing regulation, Article 17.4 says that the office can refuse to register a transfer if it thinks that by reason of the transfer, it will mislead the public as regards anything to do with the usual sort of terminology. Is it going to mislead? As far as I know, they've never asserted that. How on earth would they go about establishing it? And Max Planck said, basically, this is bonkers. Get rid of it. And they have. It's gone. There's quite a lot in there about procedures for recording transfers, which I am not going to go over. Article 18, transfer of European Union trademarks registered by an agent. So this is where an agent basically steals your mark, refuses to give it back. The existing Article 18 says that the rightful proprietor can request a transfer, but it doesn't set out any means for actually doing that or say where it should be done. So they've taken the opportunity to say how that can happen. The new Article 18.2 is going to permit a request for transfer from an agent or representative, and you can make that request to the office instead of making an application for invalidity under Article 53, or to a European Union trademark court instead of bringing a counterclaim for invalidity. Now, I'm not entirely sure why they'd say it's instead of. Why not be able to do both in the alternative? But the wording clearly says instead of. Nevertheless, it is positive because at least there is now a procedure for doing it. Article 25, funding applications. National offices have gone. You won't be able to trot down to the UKIPO anymore and file a community trademark application there. Which again, being old-fashioned, I'll miss that. Did that a few times. Article 26, really the big issue on Article 26 is that three classes have gone. You won't be able to say to your American clients, this is great value for money, you get three classes in one go. It's going to be one class with additional fees. The fee for the first extra class, I think, is €50, then €150 thereafter. Won't bore you with the rest of that slide. Date of filing. Again, the reference to filing by the National Office is gone because that ties in with Article 25. In the 2013 document, and that was following Max Planck, there was a suggestion that that 1 month grace period, which, let's face it, has got a few of us out of trouble over the years, for paying that fee, the application fee, was going to be removed. I'm quite pleased to see it's come back in. So we can all rest a little easier, if necessary. Right, this is, from a trademark attorney's point of view, the money slide. This is where there is a possibility for someone to take an opportunity to do well out of this entire process. Article 28 deals with classification, and the amendments deal with the effect of IP translator. So, and quite a chunk of this is imported from the existing implementing regulation, but we'll get on to the IP translator bit in just a minute. So the goods and services have to be defined with sufficient clarity to enable the protection sought to be determined. Class headings can be used if they are clear and precise. As you know, some of them are not. Some of them are identified as being a little less than precise. I think Class 37 is one of them. So do be careful about that. There's a list of them on the OIM website. General terms will be taken to cover all goods or services covered by the literal meaning of the term. And the stuff there about how you rank multi-class applications and so on, and that similarity and dissimilarity is not affected by classification. New Article 28.8. Old registrations filed before 22nd of June 2012, which cover entire class headings. The proprietor can declare within 6 months, quite a short window, within 6 months of the in-force date of the new regulation, whenever that may be, that it was intended to cover goods and services going beyond the literal meaning, provided the extra goods and services are listed in the declaration and were in the Nice alphabetical list in force at the filing date. If you don't file a declaration, you'll be treated as having just the literal meanings of the class heading from the end of that period. So this is where it's possible to go back to your client. Think how many hundreds of thousands of community trademarks were filed before the 22nd of June 2012 and how many of those cover class headings. And all the opportunities for engaging with your clients in an appropriate professional way to safeguard their rights by making sure you file applications with the appropriate fee and professional charge, of course, to amend specifications going forward. The downside is you only get 6 months. Now, I'm pretty certain that period of 6 months is actually an improvement on the 2013 proposal, which I think was only 4 months, which would have been manic. You can imagine what it's going to be like on the last day of that 6 months. If you are going to be at the European Community Trademark Office on that date, it's going to be horrific, particularly if they're trying to do everything by electronic means. But nevertheless, that is an opportunity for anyone managing a portfolio to re-establish contact with clients who may have been quiet for some time. Who knows? And 28A is just a saving for vested rights, of course. I'm not going to say much about priority except, and this is an important docket point, that you will not be able to make a late claim to priority in the future. That's gone. Which is a shame, because again, it was the sort of thing that people often relied on to solve problems where people had forgot to tell you about priority, for example. Has anybody ever claimed exhibition priority? Oh, please, somebody must have done. Oh, God. I've never seen a claim for exhibition priority. All I'm going to say about it is they brought it into line with Article 30 on convention priority. Oh, seniority. I don't think I really need to say much about that. It's pretty much the same as it is. There is a slight change to the effect of revocation on seniority. It says it will lapse when the earlier mark is cancelled. If the earlier mark's cancellation is by way of revocation, seniority will lapse provided the base mark is revoked from a date before the filing of priority with the European Union trademark. And I'm sure we're all sad to see that in Article 37, disclaimers are no more. We shall weep for them as we weep for the title of the office, unfortunately. Searches. Aha! This was an interesting one because the 2013 proposal said very clearly, searches are going. We don't like searches. We're taking them away. It's a big red line through Article 28, all gone. Somewhere along the line, someone has argued very forcibly, presumably in order to protect the interests of smaller owners, who knows. But searches are staying. They're back in again. Only from now on, they're optional. And that includes the European Union search. You'll have to request it and you'll have to pay a fee. I'm guessing there won't be a stampede, given the standard of search that you get from the European Union. There is also going to be continued notification whether or not the search is requested. So they will be doing the search, no matter what. But notification won't occur if the proprietor of an earlier mark requests not to receive the notification. Nothing there about how that notification is going to be affected. And I seem to recall that with the IPO, we've been there before on this, haven't we? Opting out and so on. So it'll be interesting to see how that one pans out. Observations. Very slight change. They have expanded the grounds on which you can lodge observations. It used to be on absolute grounds for refusal levy, Article 7. They've now included, for whatever reason, Article 5. Don't know why. Article 5 deals with proprietorship. So presumably you can bring a claim saying this person is not, or an observation saying, this person is not entitled to be the proprietor. They've actually set out a specific deadlines for when observations can be filed. Either the end of the opposition period, if no opposition is filed, or if an opposition is filed, the point at which the decision becomes final. Right. Opposition. I'm not going to worry about Article 41. It was a minor change. Again, the bad faith ground of opposition didn't get in, which, as far as I'm concerned, is a matter of some regret. I think it's unfortunate it wasn't put in. There is an important change to the proof of use provision. Currently, of course, you can request proof of use if the earlier marks attacking you have been registered for 5 years or more at the date your mark is published for opposition purposes. That's changing. It will now, but that five-year period will now be reckoned from the filing or priority date, if that's earlier, of your application. And because we're running a bit tight on time, I'll tell you that is reflected through all of the proof of use provisions. It's always going to be judged back to the filing or priority date of your mark, not to the date of its publication. Renewal, another docket point. They specifically now state that they will give 6 months' notice if they fail to send out the notice. Tough. There's no recourse on them. The current requirement is that you can file the notice of renewal in the 6 months ending on the last day of the month of expiry. That's now being changed, so it will be the expiry date that counts. So there's going to be a lot of, I'm sure most of the computerised systems will update automatically, your template will have to change and so on, and you'll obviously have to watch for those dates being slightly different. Article 53, just updated to reflect the other changes on relative rights. Oh, let's see. Acquiescence, I mentioned earlier, goes back to 13A. There's a potentially important change to 56.3. 56.3 dealt with res judicata on invalidity actions. Basically, it said that you couldn't bring a claim for invalidity if the matter had already been decided by a court, same grounds, same parties, same issues, in a member state. They've now expanded that to say if it had been decided in the office. So it's the office or a member state. So you get one shot, get it wrong, can't bring it again. Again, Article 57 changed to cover that proof of use point I mentioned earlier. Article 60, you will be able to, if you're a defendant to an appeal, you can bring in grounds that were not mentioned by the appellant. Don't know what prompted that change. The right will lapse if the appellant actually discontinues. Article 62, another much-loved article as far as I'm concerned that is going. Article 62 was the one that said if you file an appeal, then the case gets sent back to the department concerned so they can revise it and check if they've made a mistake. Now, I used to like that because it meant they had to do all that work all over again. And I hated the fact that we'd had to do an appeal in the first place. So it was nice to think that they were being made to suffer some of the pain. It's a terrible shame. They got rid of it completely because apparently not one single case has ever been revised. They're just not trying hard enough, are they, really? I think it's a coward's way out. Appeals to the Court of Justice, it now refers to the General Court. There is a big chunk on collective and certification marks. Personally, I take the view that life and this particular session are too short to talk about certification marks. All of us here would have done certification marks to death when we were training as trademark attorneys, and it's pretty much a standard package. And really the only changes are, A, to introduce certification marks, and it looks like certification marks everywhere, and to bring it in line with the rest of the regulation. So I'm not going to say another word about that. Not going to mention 76 because it's very dull. Revocation of decisions. Okay, it's a small change of wording, but if you're trying to deal with a problem where the officer's messed up, it could be an important one. The current wording of Article 80, sub 1, talks about rectification of procedural errors. They've taken the word procedural out, so it covers any error that they've made. That could turn out, in some situations, to be quite important, depending on the error that they've made. And the period for actually putting the decision right has been extended from 6 months to 1 year, which probably reflects the fact they didn't have enough time to turn them around in 6 months. It's in the nature of things that 1 year in a few years won't be enough either, but there you go. Very quick word on cost. There was quite a bit of chat, I think, in Max Planck to say that the cost regime, in terms of enforcing costs, actually wasn't working terribly well. There's quite a lot of confusion around it. They are going to be requiring member states to designate a single authority to authenticate cost orders. Is that going to make a difference? No, because it's going to cost thousands to enforce the orders and you've only got €600 worth of cost to recover. It probably won't make a huge difference at all. I'm not going to talk about inspection of files. Representation, well, it naturally follows that because they've extended the rights effective to the European Economic Area, then people who are not within the European Economic Area, they will still need to be represented. You can have employee representation in the EEA, and legal practitioners or professional representatives in the EEA will be entitled to appear before the office. And that presumably means they'll be going on the register as well. How are we doing, Chris? Minute, 2 minutes?
We are on the point of throwing things
out. Okay, well, in that case, this is all pretty dull stuff, so I'll just move on. International registration. The opposition period's coming down. Currently, total of 9 months, 6 plus 3. It's going to be reduced to effectively 4. It'll be 1 month, 3 months starting 1 month from republication. So that's going to be another docket point for you. Okay, so we are actually on the last slide. I have skipped out a couple, but none of them are going to change your life. This one is, because this is about fees. We like slides about fees, don't we? Because this effectively means it's all getting a lot cheaper, which is excellent. But I say a lot cheaper. It's certainly getting cheaper. Yes, of course, we have the... it's only a one-class application now, plus additional classes, but it's only €1,850 on an e-filing. Collective marks, oh, a bargain at 1,800. Opposition, I think that fee's come down from 350 to 320, so you'd be saving €30 every time you file an opposition. Well, your clients love you. Renewal fees will be the same as the application. Cancellations down to 630. Appeal will be €720. €720, I don't know why I'm saying euros. First and not second. That's now included in an annex, and they've got delegated powers to change it as necessary, so there won't be a separate fees regulation. And that is pretty much it.